Hey, Mac, when does deer season start?
Well, if you want the best deer herd possible, Lanny, you need to start right now.
Right now.
That's why we're starting our promotion. I mean, we've got a Deer Season Starts Now promotion on plantbiologic.com where you can pick up our Game Changer soybeans, our forage soybeans, and our spring protein peas. While you're there, you might as well go ahead and pick up some brassicas like our final forage and winter bowls.
Yeah, stock up for the cool season planting right now. Listeners to the GK Podcast, if you use coupon code GKPOD, you can save an additional 10% off our entire selection of warm season, cool season, and clover food plot seed. Get started today and visit plantbiologic.com for an unforgettable fall.
I am Jeff Foxworthy, and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
We're live in 3, 2, 1.
All right, everybody, welcome to West Point, Mississippi, home of Mossy Oak brand camo, and you better fasten your seatbelt today.
That's right.
That this is going to be, listen to that. I hope we don't get in any kind of legal trouble by playing that, Richie. But we'll soon find out.
We'll soon find out. That's right. We'll find out who's listening.
So we've done a lot of podcasts. I think this is about our 180th.
Oh my goodness! Mm-hmm. But
this is going to be really interesting discussion.
Epic for me.
Epic, no doubt about it.
Yep.
Yeah. So Toxie, when you've been around here a long time, you've been around a long time.
Well, careful now.
Back at those, remember those sock hops that you used to go to?
Yeah. No, I was older when those, I outgrew those.
Yeah, the dances back when we were in the 10th and 11th grade.
Yeah, we did the jitterbug mostly in my generation.
Mm. Wow.
Well, where I was, that the Allman Brothers Band were a big deal.
It's a big deal, no question about it.
So, look, let me just go ahead and introduce him. I don't know any other way to do it, but we've got a guest through the magic of the internet. We've got Mr. Chuck Lavelle.
Bring the horn.
And so how do I say this? I mean, this guy was part of the Allman Brothers Band. He's part of the Rolling Stones. He's been on so much. He's just a
musical icon.
He really and truly.
So everybody watching or listening to this, go pull it up, download it, whatever, and watch The Tree Man.
The Tree Man.
I have rarely looked at something that was rated 100% Rotten Tomatoes, but this one is.
Yeah.
And it is indeed. Because it's just a walk in life with Chuck, and it's so good.
Yeah, it's a great
history
story.
The band, the music, and then also his care for the earth and love of trees. It's incredible.
Dudley.
Yeah, so I'm a huge live music fan. And
you like trees too, don't you?
Yeah, and I love trees. And I want maybe in 1994, I saw Chuck on stage in Memphis with the Rolling Stones.
Wow.
And about that same time, I read a magazine article in the National Wild Turkey Federation that was all about Chuck and what he does. And ever since then, he's kind of been my beacon. You know, he's also into trees, into the outdoors, and we have very similar musical taste. So this is a big deal. Ever since we've had a podcast, this was the one I wanted to have.
And bucket list.
I was on a flight and saw the Tree Man. And I said, I think we've got a chance of getting him on and talking about it because we're so similar.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Look, Chuck, I'm going to be honest with you. He hasn't slept in 3 nights. He's so excited about it.
I bet Chuck has.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, first of all, it's just great to be with you. Thank you, fellas, for inviting me. I love everything that Mossy Oak does. You guys have such a beautiful brand, and I'm very, very proud and honored to be on your podcast. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Well,
it
so
means a lot.
We've looking around the room, we talked about it. How are we going to get started? What are we going to ask? I know everybody's got a bunch of questions. But, Chuck, before we get started, there's just one little piece of business we need to kind of – I want to talk about just real fast. But we have a segment called Blood on the Biologic, and as hunting season approaches, you know, a lot of times we point out folks that have had successful hunts. I'd really like to get more kids involved in this. So please just hashtag us that hashtag Blood on the Biologic, and we'll see them. But Lanny, I wanted to show you Dave Larson.
What?
Dave Larson.
Is he on the board?
Wisconsin killed a great big old black bear.
Look at there. We got visuals. Look at
Dave
you,
Larson from Core Resources. They make the Gamekeeper clothes.
That's a big old bear.
Yeah, he was real excited. Dudley, he said there's more acorns this year up there than he can remember. He said all the deer are super fat. The bears have a lot to eat. But guys, I want to show you one more picture. Look at this Colton Goodwin. Look at the
wow.
rack on this deer.
Wow. And he's got his sheds from the year before.
Mm-hmm. Can you? If I told you that was killed in the South, would you believe me?
That's a giant deer.
North Carolina.
Wow.
It's incredible.
You know, that almost looks like some of those big city deer people kill around Atlanta.
Might be.
Big old high and tight.
That deer was definitely eaten by a logic just looking at his horns. I'm going to tell you.
Incredible. I would agree with you. Look, congratulations, guys. And so that's what we had, Blood on the Biologic, brought to you by LS Tractors. And Chuck, I apologize. I don't think you could see those images, but trust us, they were really pretty.
They were.
So, look, we've thought about this. I want to, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask the first question.
Chuck. Of course you would.
So I've watched The Tree Man, and Matt, you need to jump in here too. Watch The Tree Man and understand this farm you've got over there in Georgia. And I've been thinking about all kind of questions I could ask you. And the first thing I wanted to ask you is, do you have any turkeys? And if so, could I come over there this next spring?
He never ends.
Let's see what we can do. Yeah, we've had a fair turkey season. Last year was a little bit off. 2 to 3 years ago, the numbers were really, really strong. So, yes, we do have them. Not quite as many as I would like to have at
there's
present.
There's no such thing, is it?
There's no such thing as too many.
Yeah, that's right. But, when you realize what the state of Georgia did, and I can't remember exactly when it was, but it was probably close to 30 years ago, I guess, where there was hardly any turkeys in the state, and they closed the season and they stocked turkeys. And it's just been an incredible success story throughout the state. So
that's amazing.
Glad to say that we do have them.
Music to our ears.
We're so blessed to have the population we have. But the good news is everybody is so concerned about preservation for the future. I say almost everybody. And it's really raised the awareness of what's going on today. And funded a lot of really meaningful research. There's a lot of great projects going on today.
Sure is. Well, look, before Dudley pees on himself here, go ahead, Dudley.
Well, I really just want you to go over some of the things you're doing so our listeners can understand, your purpose here. I've been studying up on America's Forests with Chuck and really enjoying watching that series. And you just seem to shine a light on the forestry and forest products industry in general. And we're talking about, trees that, naturally occur here. And they do grow back. So can you just go into the details a little bit about that show? Some of the places you've been, the process.
Absolutely. So for those that may not know, America's Forest with Chuck Lavelle runs on PBS, and it's also available on Amazon Prime. So if anybody wants to call that up, you can find it easily. You guys probably know that I've written some books on the subject of forestry and the environment. And I also, from time to time, give presentations and speeches to various different groups, trying to help educate people on the importance of forestry and environment and the natural world. And through this process and through the years, I thought to myself, the best way to get these messages out would really be to have a television program. And so my partner, Bruce Ward, and I got together and we kicked around some ideas and kicked around some titles. And we came up with the idea of America's Forests. And so this gives us a chance to go throughout the country, finding these incredible stories of people that are doing beautiful things that have to do with, and by the way, it's not all just about the forest. It's about what's within the forest, largely wildlife. Just about every segment and episode we've done has something about wildlife in it. We've had the grouse program. We've had wild turkey, you mentioned. deer, you know, everything. So that's the whole impetus, is to have a fun program. We have a little music in it. Being a musician, that's a pretty natural thing to do. Try to have some humor in it, but also talk about all the problems that we do face, the challenges, things like wildfires out in California and the Pacific Northwest and other places, what's being done to help prevent those wildfires, forest products that you were so kind to mention a little bit earlier. You know, I like to tell people our trees give us materials to build our homes, schools, churches, offices, to make books, magazines, and newspapers. They clean our air. They clean our water. And, of course, there's the incredible aesthetic value that we all appreciate about forests.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool at the, you know, I don't want to spoil it, but, you know, at the end, he'll get together with some local musicians and put on a little show.
That's incredible.
They'll, you know, they'll just showcase the culture of that area. You know, you may go to an Aspen Grove and go snowmobiling and look around. You may go fishing. It's really cool. Everybody needs to watch it.
Yeah, one of the episodes I watched was in the Wachita, in Arkansas, in the Wachita Forest. Man, it was amazing just seeing the culture. And then one of the ladies that you had on there, she was paddling through those I think it was Tupelo gum cypress or stumps.
Yes.
In a breakup canoe, in a mossy oak canoe, by the way.
Got taste.
And look, hand grabbed a water snake, a big one. I mean, just rode up there and pulled it up, man. It's really entertaining. So I really enjoyed it, to Dudley's point, because we often, you know, us here, we tend to micro focus on the forest, and it really showed me the impact that forest has, not only on the culture and the people and the wildlife and everything. So good job.
Well, we have a lot of fun with it, as I mentioned. You know, we try to have a little humor in there as well. But it's really meant to be an educational show. And you guys know this. There's so many misconceptions and just misgivings that a lot of people have about what we do as hunters, as, you know, people that manage land and look after the land. And we were talking before the actual broadcast began about how the mantra is to leave our land in better shape than we found it. Mm-hmm. That's certainly the mantra that I try to live by. 100%. And that's the mantra that we try to project with the program.
It's so important. You know, you're similar in that you're just following your passion, just right out there into the public eye and trying to make a difference. But, you know, in today's world with all the poison going on out there, literally spiritually, politically, you know, and obviously from environmental poisons and stuff too. We can't stick our head in the sand. It's been so easy through the last years of the great American story to just stick your head in the sand. It'll take care of itself. What are you so worried about it for? Whether it's the, you know, the national debt or anything else too. But when you start losing something you love, you change your tune a little bit. And so for us, you know, the wild turkey, is, I mentioned that a minute ago, has changed, but people don't see the forest effect, not the average, you know, living in a city, not around the stuff. And so for Chuck to be able to raise the awareness of that, we better, I would say, pay as much or more attention to trees in this earth than anything going on. Maybe the oceans come first, but beyond that, and I'm an environmentalist at heart. I'm not trained as one. But we better pay attention is all I'm getting to. And I know people criticize, I'm a little preachy on this show, but when you're talking about the earth we live on and the critters, sorry, I will be preachy. I just thank you, Chuck, for bringing that awareness to everybody and, you know, the truth. And what the good thing is that more and more people, you know, through our own nursery and selling trees and all, we've just tried to always put the tools in people's hands and so everybody can participate. And, you know, it seems like every year more and more people are diverting more of their, like, land management budget to replanting trees. If you ever get them started and then in subsequent years they see the results, then you got them hooked. And they start doing a little bit every year and they realize that golden message that my dad said that we all kind of live by here as gamekeepers. The good that men do live long after they're gone.
Yep.
What a cool thing.
Well
you,
said.
You
well
embody said. It. I mean, you big time embody it.
Your daughter's been begging you to hunt since her little brother shot the big 8 last year. You've ran a fire, dissed the fields, got stuck, got unstuck. Planted food plots, fertilized, and prayed for rain. You moved trees, limbed roads, even bought one of those fancy cell cameras.
So what's your excuse?
LS Tractor.
Nosler Ballistic Tip Ammunition is made for knocking down deer right where they stand. Nosler's Ballistic Tip Bullet is the key. It has the controlled expansion and bone-crushing punch to turn a whitetail's lights out. Bring home more deer this year with Ballistic Tip Ammunition. Buy now at Nosler.com.
I think we were talking a little bit before the podcast also about how you're just a perfect vehicle for this, because you're in touch with all different types of people through your music ventures. And a lot of those people may not understand how ecosystems work in a forested setting. Right. And you're the perfect person to relay that information to the whole world.
Yeah, he's got the platform. So thanks for doing that, by the way.
Chuck, why don't you squeeze a word in here, please?
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have had a pen and paper.
One thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, what are some of the things you enjoy doing at your own place in Georgia? What are some, maybe some treatments you do to your trees, or, you know, what do you like to do out there?
Well, we were talking earlier, I think you guys have a prescribed burn coming up today, yep, later on. And certainly, of course, this time of year, most of the burns that we do around here are for site prepping, mm-hmm, to plant trees,
right,
because we're in the warm weather time. But our prescribed burns usually start somewhere around February, maybe March, go into April. That's certainly an activity that I enjoy, because I think it's one of the best tools that landowners have to manage their land. Of course, you have to be extremely careful, and you have to know what you're doing. You have to be educated about it, but it is an incredible tool. So, you know, that's one of the activities we do. But, you know, planting feed plots for the deer, for the quail, for the turkey. We have a commercial quail hunting operation here at Charlane, Charlane. And the way we came up with that name is the first few letters of my proper name, Charles, Char, and my wife's middle name is Lane, Lane.
How about that?
So we came up with Charlane Woodlands. And our season runs from mid-October until mid-March with the quail hunting. We have a lodge. We have several accommodations that we enjoy putting people up. Great cooks, great guides, wow, the jeeps, the dogs. And so I engage in that. One of the things I like doing, guys, is we'll get the customers out into the field, and then I'll go to the horse barn, saddle up a horse, and go visit the various hunting parties. And of course, that adds a little bit of color to the operation.
That's awesome.
And helps us to socialize with our clients. And we've been doing this since the early 90s. You know, it's like music to me, man. You, yes, know, I love doing it. It's an honor. It's a pleasure to do it. And we enjoy it. So, you know, that's coming up pretty quick. We're here in September. So October's around the corner, and we'll start our activities there.
So Charlane is located in South Central Georgia.
Really, it's right in the middle of the state. There's a a plaque not far from us, probably 3/4 mile away, that indicates the geographical center of Georgia.
Okay.
So we are literally in the center of the state. We're below Macon, about 20 miles.
Okay. How about that?
We may have to book an afternoon over there, Bob.
Yeah. That would be
Come
fun.
On, guys. Yeah.
You know, Chuck, I grew up, that was my rite of passage, really, was the quail hunting at the time. My dad was a cattle buyer for Brian Foods, and so he would, and a lot of, most of his sales he bought from were in Alabama. He'd go as far as Selma and over, I forgot where, a little bit east of there, and but he would take his bird dogs and put them in the trunk of his car, tie a little rope to keep, they could get air in there, and had food and water and stuff for him. And then after the sale, probably 3 or 4 times a week, of course, every cattle owner wanted him to go with them because he was the largest buyer of cattle because of the Mr. Bryan's operation here. Anyway, he quail hunted every day of the week, say 4 days a week, probably for 6 or 8, 10 years. And that was his thing, quail. So I grew up on a farm, a wild buck, and that's one of the first things I was able to do when I was old enough to take a gun and go by myself is he had one dog he'd let me take, old Mike, and that was it because he knew he would stay real close to me and wouldn't get lost. And so I can't even tell you how many hundreds of days I would go bird hunting, and I'd be so excited if I killed one or two. But we had a lot of birds back then. So love that modern-day quail operations are keeping that alive. You know, for people to experience, and with especially the dogs and all that, it's just yeah, magic.
Well, you know, and as you guys, I'm sure, would agree, it's not about how many times you pull the trigger.
No.
But it's about just being outdoors, being able to get the exercise of walking behind the dogs, watching those dogs work. That's so fascinating to me. And I love that you gave me that story because I have a similar one, even though for me it happened much later in life. And by the way, my wife and I, Rose Lane, we just celebrated our 50th anniversary.
Wow.
Congratulations.
Hit the horns.
Yeah. Wow.
Yes, sir.
That's
incredible.
Amazing.
Thank you. That is amazing.
Thank you. But the way I got into it, guys, was I was invited by the family to a dove shoot, and I had never been on a dove shoot before. And of course, I think I was maybe 20 years old at the time. And I was in the corner of the field with Rose Lane's uncle, whom we affectionately call Baby Joe. And Baby Joe weighed about, you know, 250 pounds. He was a very big man, very stocky, and a wonderful guy. You know, I'm missing every dove that flies by me. And all of a sudden, a covey of quail burst, you know, scared the bejesus out of me. And I said, "Dang, Joe, what was that?" And Joe said, "Them birds, boy. You want to go bird hunting?" I said, "I reckon I do." He showed up at the house the next day, just as you described. He had a couple of shotguns in the back seat of a Chevrolet Impala,
right,
with two bird dogs in the trunk.
Yep, exactly.
And we went around every field that the family had, and I had the time of my life, and I was hooked.
Mm. Yes.
How about that? That's a great story.
And Bobby always has just coveted.
He's glowing over there.
Yes, yeah, Bobby loves to quail hunt. I mean,
dogs.
It is magic, you know. The only thing, even, you know, we have in Mr. Gibson, I think he raises a few German shorthairs, but we have a dog kennel here. We raise dog and train dogs, largely British Labradors, which we adore watching the dog work. We just don't have – there's some, and there's some really good ones in this area, but they're not as many – I mean, Georgia is known for the best, you know, commercial quail hunting that there is in the country. It's just known for it. It's spread through there so much. I wish we had more, and I wish more people could own the bird dogs and had something to do with them. Personally, for us, you know, we're starting to see the more I burn, the more wild quail we keep seeing. And they're starting to come back, actually.
I think it's a trend. You know, a lot of folks are now understanding the importance of the early successional habitat,
yes,
you know, at their own farms. And because of that, we're starting to, you know, the turkey poults are becoming more successful.
Yeah.
Quail are being more successful. So maybe we're going in the right direction again. I hope.
The biggest light bulb that went off with me in doing these and listening to so many good biologists was the guy from Oklahoma State who was the Rio expert. And he explained why they have so many quail in Texas and Oklahoma still. He said, our habitat is so poor. Our soils are so poor and arid that our habitat can never get out of that early successional stage. We have perfect nesting habitat perpetually where, you know, at your farm or at ours, we've got to manage to keep some of that in that early succession for optimal. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing how that burning, even in growing pine plantations, will give you that same effect.
Yeah, especially if you have a slightly wider spacing than
exactly
normally recommended.
Well, you know, when I first started learning about this, the Bible of quail management was written by a guy named Herbert Stoddard back in the 30s, and he was hired to do very lengthy study by a lot of the landowners in South Georgia and in other parts of the South. And then years later, Walter Rosine followed up in the 60s with another book concerning the habitat. But it really goes to what you guys are just saying, you know, to the early successional frequent burning, as we know, you want to checkerboard things up and leave some nesting habitat when you're doing these burns and whatnot. But if you manage it, I was just thinking when you guys were talking about it, build it and they will come. Right?
Yes,
that's right.
If you have the habitat, you're going to have the birds.
Just wondering, you know, obviously I've noticed, you know, intense management of pines and those kind of things. I just didn't know, do you do much hardwood tree management? And if you did, you know, do you have a species that you really like to focus on?
Well, you know, most of what we have is what we would term southern yellow pine, of course, loblolly, some slash. And then there has been, as you guys know, an effort through the last probably 30 years to reintroduce longleaf pine.
I noticed that.
Yes.
Which used to be the dominant pine species from Virginia down to East Texas. And we have engaged in that. I think we have about 350 acres of longleaf that we've planted through the years.
Wow.
But to answer your question, yes, we have some upland and lowland hardwoods. You know, don't harvest them too much. We do sometimes for when it's appropriate to do so. But I like to leave the best ones there for the acorns.
Yes,
right?
Sir.
And we are fortunate to have some wetlands as well. So we got some really good duck habitat. And we also have one man-made, it's a small one, but it's a drain and flood duck pond. The pond itself is about 10 acres. And we have the means to, we have a well and a pump to fill it up if we don't get the rain.
Oh, that's nice.
That's a great size too. Because isn't it fun to mess with it and landscape it when you can drain it and do things, you know, because a lot of ours we can't drain. And I've always like, I've probably been 15 years. I want to plant a grove of trees here and there, but some of our stuff we can't really drain and control like that. Mm-hmm. And so it's nice to be able to do it. You feel like you got to paint and then you go back and paint in subsequent years. You know,
though, well, that's right. And of course, we plant some corn, but we've also had a lot of success with golden millet.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, yeah. We include that in our millet blend now. Isn't that right, Bobby?
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
Yep. Thought so.
Yeah. That's good stuff.
Yeah, man.
That's awesome. He said postage stamp on the burning, but if you listen to his comments about the jewel of a place he has, it's so diverse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what everybody we talk to that has experience, especially biologists above all else, they go back to the same thing, diversity, diversity, diversity.
Diversity wins. Yeah, yep. I saw a photo of you and maybe some of your family members with straps of wood ducks, I'm assuming near that duck hole.
Exactly, yes. I know the photo you're talking about. It was family members, absolutely. But as long as we're talking diversity, I would love to mention about the American Chestnut Foundation.
Yes.
Near and dear to us.
I'm very happy to work with those guys. And they have a brand new documentary out that it would be good for people to Google up and to watch. There's been some success in breeding 15/16 American chestnut to 1/16 Chinese chestnut to have some resistance to the drought. And the other technology being used that I find really interesting is genome technology, where they're actually injecting a gene into the young trees that give it a resistance to the drought. And,
wow.
And this has the potential to be a faster situation, because, you know, breeding the 15/16 to 1/16, you have to do it over and over and over again.
Right.
Takes years and years, but the genome technology can move a lot faster. So fingers crossed that turns out to be a positive thing for us.
That's interesting. The first I've heard of that.
Yeah. It's an interesting project. We probably need to podcast. In fact, Will Primos recommended the gentleman that runs the New York chapter that we ought to podcast with to learn more. But yeah, they're using genetics from the wheat plant.
Yes.
To keep the blight at bay in the chestnut.
Exactly. So could it
so
be?
They've got a pure American chestnut.
And it's called, the name of the actual cultivar or selection or whatever is called Darling 58.
Well, you let your
know-it-all. Yeah, so, let me ask you this, though. Does that pass along to its...
Yes.
Seed. So that would be so important where the crossbreeding, the 15/16, we've known about that for 15 or more years.
Yeah, we
that doesn't that. Pass along.
Right. And okay. It's interesting. And, and all the chestnuts, like there's also an Ozark Chinkapin Foundation, which is a
Another mm-hmm. native chestnut. It's a one-seeded chestnut.
Right.
And they're based out of Arkansas. We did podcast with them, and we're hoping to start an orchard. So it's another native chestnut that has timber form.
Yeah.
But yeah, interesting stuff.
We need to send Chuck some trees.
Yeah, people
we're
need to understand
some trees.
Yeah, that the American landscape used to be what dominated by American chestnuts.
East of the Mississippi, yeah.
Yeah, through the Appalachian area mainly up in the mountains, but it extended a little bit beyond that as well. But wouldn't it be great to bring the tree back?
100%.
Oh man, that would be. You talking about something gives me chill bumps thinking that as we speak before our time passes here on Earth, that we would have been a part of something like that.
Yes.
And restoring them. So that's the first I'd heard about the genome
mm-hmm.
research. Yeah, that's incredible, Dudley.
Hmm. So Chuck, let me ask you a serious question. So can you remember back at whatever point it was in your life where you stood looking at a forest and you just became fascinated and decided I'm just really going to be interested in this and learn more about it? What event led to that happening?
Good question.
Well, you know, being a child of the 60s, we all remember the pollution and the challenges that we had back then. And there was this growing feeling of what are we doing to the environment? And then, of course, in the 60s, things started to change. Well, 70s, I should say. They established the agencies that started looking after the land and we started doing better. But, you know, I grew up in Alabama, guys, right next door to you guys there. And I just remember, you know, the phrase that we use for Alabama is Alabama the Beautiful. And it is a beautiful state. And when you ask my first memories of just, you know, for a time when I was very young, six and 7 years old, we lived in the country in Montgomery, outside of Montgomery.
Wow.
And we had a little 8-acre place. We had three horses. We were surrounded by forests. And I just remember so playing in the creek with my sister, you know, just hanging out in nature and enjoying it. So that's my first memory of, wow, isn't this cool, you know, to be living in nature and be able to be a part of it. And, you know, we'd find snakes in the barn and all of the things that go along with country living back then. So that's my earliest memory of it.
Wow. That's great.
There's just, you know, for everybody listening out there too, there's something medicinal for your life and your spirit. I don't want to get too kooky on folks, but it is. In planting a tree and adding to what's going on in the earth is supposed to take it away from. There's something so medicinal. And I hope that people that, you know, that grew up in urban environments, you know, can even do that, you know, even in their yard and stuff. Everybody would participate
mm-hmm. yeah.
everywhere. It adds so much. In fact, it's actually, I think it's proven now. There's another podcast talk about, they have these recovery centers for people and they use pets and nature and they plant things and they, you know, work in flowers and plant gardens. And actually they are healing people with nature more and more. It's fascinating.
Well, and Chuck, I just watching the tree, man, you made me aware of a quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson that I never heard before. And it's, in the woods, we return to reason and faith.
That's awesome.
Yeah. You, Mr. Know-it-all.
I tell you, I write some stuff down, Richie.
Chuck,
it was a real enlightening moment.
It was for me.
Who was Ralph Waldo?
I don't know. I know who Chuck is. You know, I don't read much, but I do listen to music.
I do love that quote. And, you know, I think it's so true. You know, we all have parts of our lives. You know, when I'm out touring with the Stones or with others, you're in big cities with electric atmospheres and horns honking and just all of the vibrations that you get from doing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, when you take that, I get home and take that walk in the woods, it's so healing.
Oh God.
And it also helps to keep me grounded. You know, it makes me understand what's really important in life and what the priorities should be. But I loved your comment about how a lot of people with PTSD or other maladies, psychologically are being healed by spending time in nature, spending time with animals and that kind of thing. So, you know, there's a lot to that. And I think we could all use as much of the dose of nature as we can get out there. You know, I think absolutely. It's so important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even in inner cities, guys, and I know y'all know this, but even in the inner cities, when you can create green spaces, parks, yes. In Atlanta, here in the state of Georgia, they came up with the Beltline, which was the old train route that circles around the city, and they've planted beautiful trees and have little parks along the way. Anytime that we can help do that in the metropolitan areas, I think it's so helpful for people to get a dose of that.
Yeah, we actually have some of our trees growing on that Beltline mm-hmm. that we sent somebody 5 or 6 years ago.
And I love that, you know, you guys mentioning just the effort of planting a tree and watching it grow through years. Oh, you know, we plant trees for our grandchildren and, you know, name them after the grandchildren. You know, when we have the loss of a loved one, we usually plant trees yes. in memory. And so these are things that can stick with you, you know, stick in your heart. It helps you to remember the good times that you spent with people or the good times you spent with your children when they were growing up or grandchildren. So it's a great exercise to do. And I'd like to see it happen more and more in schools, you know, and it is happening. You get schools that have some outdoor classroom property and they can maybe grow some vegetables or hopefully engage in planting trees around their places.
Absolutely.
We're seeing more and more of that, and that's a good thing.
Moultrie was first in feeders since 1979 and is the leader in total game management. They're taking feeding to another level with the new Ranch Series line of durable and versatile feeders, perfect for both wildlife and domestic livestock. So, Dudley, you can feed your goats. Whether you're a deer hunter, a hobby farmer, a land manager, or a rancher, Moultrie has you covered with several kit options, including a rotating auger, broadcast, or a gravity kit. And these feeders are 300 or 450 pounds. They're big feeders. All right, so guys, Moultrie is offering our listeners a 15% site-wide discount at MoultrieFeeders.com. Use code MossyOak with a capital M, MossyOak, at MoultrieFeeders.com and get that 15% discount.
The Furminator is the industry's most versatile piece of food plot equipment, allowing plotters to do every step of the process, working the soil, adding seed and soil supplements, and compacting. From start to finish, with a single implement, it's hassle-free by design. Set it for the seed size and simply drive the tractor, and the Furminator does the rest. Check it out at TheFurminator.com.
So, Chuck, I'm going to ask you another serious question. And so in my mind's eye, I picture maybe on as you tour with the Stones on some Tuesday night, you guys are probably hanging out in the green room before you go out on a concert, and you might be watching the Gamekeepers of Mossy Oak television show all day.
Of course.
I'm picturing that.
I'm sure Mick.
It's Mick's favorite show,
yeah,
man.
Yeah. But so as you travel, and you mentioned it earlier, the electronic vibrations of this circle that you sometimes travel in to make your living, and you're so good at what you do, and we're just so impressed. But my point that I'm trying to get around is there a way that you see that we as hunters could portray ourselves better to the non-hunting public? Is there any advice that you could give us from hearing from that other side and what they think of us, ways that we could improve
ourselves? Question.
You know, it is a great question, and it is a challenge that we all face. And again, you know, that was the reason I started this effort in writing books and the effort with the television program, because to answer your question more directly, in my opinion, if we engage in parts of nature, parts of the environment that are not directly related to hunting so much, and you show songbirds, for instance, you know, look, we have a great appreciation for songbirds in the outdoors. Take the kids on a nature trail and start identifying different trees and different shrubs. It's great if you have a biologist, a botanist that can. We have a nature trail here at Charlaine, and we enjoy taking young children's groups into the woods, walking the trail. And, you know, you may see a fallen tree that's been dead for 5 years, and you look at the insects, what's happening, and what's this tree is going back into the earth. And so I think the point is, if you can talk more about the environmental aspects, and then slowly, you know, get people more comfortable with what we do as managing the wildlife, right?
Yes.
Show them those tracks in the dirt, right? So, wow, look at that turkey track, you know. Look at these deer tracks, and how do you identify the male deer from the female deer? And so I think if we can get them excited about those aspects of the outdoors, then we get them more comfortable with, you know, where we put that venison on the table and how that whole process works. Mm.
Beautifully said.
No yes. doubt about it.
You know, I have to get this blurb in there, but it reminds me, the whole conversation today is, you know, in my position is like, you got to be sure that everything's focused, everything's logical. Lanny gets an earful for me about that sometimes. And, you know, great mission statements. And we got this diverse brand now, but you got to have that central mission. And a great mission statement usually is like as few words as possible, encapsulating everything, you know. So what I came up with years ago for my own kind of private managing things, like what we do as a brand is connecting humans with nature.
And I have to say, you make a really excellent point about short phrases and what we that have spent some time in front of cameras call sound bites. You know, when I sign my books that have to do with forestry, I usually use the phrase, wood is good.
That's awesome. That's a great one. Dudley's going to poach that one from you. I can see him now.
Yeah. One of the books I like is Growing a Better America, Smart, Strong, and Sustainable.
That's solid.
That's a good one.
Yep.
Thanks, man. Thank you for that. You know, the impetus for that was traveling around and seeing, and we've all seen this in our communities, strip malls that are built and then 5-7 years later, they're abandoned and there they are sitting useless, you know. And we're going to grow as a country. I mean, that's inevitable. We are growing. We've always grown. We're going to continue to grow. But is that growth going to be rampant, reckless, or can it be smart, strong, and sustainable? And that's the point of the book is, you know, how can we deal with this ever-growing population but be smart about it and protect nature as much as we can?
We better listen. We better listen because Mother Earth is not going to forgive, you know. It's
not. Chuck, we got Mac, our fact checker, is raising his hand with a question for you.
So with watching the Tree Man documentary, I thought it was really interesting about how you said that your mom would ask you to play a sound like thunder on the piano. And it reminded me of my grandmother and with my kids now. And so with that, what would be your favorite sound in nature? Or what's something that puts you at ease or that excites you? Or what's a sound that makes you smile?
The wind in the pines.
Ah, wow. That's a good one. That is such a good one.
Man, I can hear it now.
I can too.
Maybe a few crows in the background.
Ooh, yes.
Yes, sir.
Those hollow sounds.
And the crunch of leaves underfoot. Mm.
Yeah, wow. That's good. Chuck, are y'all's muscadines about over now? Has it been a good year in Georgia?
We've had great rainfall this year, and I'm so grateful for it. You know, we've seen some storms, of course, in South Georgia and in Florida as well, as you guys know. But fortunately, we've been spared for any bad damaging storms. And the rainfall, we have a surplus. So all my trees are happy. Of course, I've never seen as much natural reproduction in my life as I've seen this year.
Wow,
I mean,
that's
I've
awesome.
Seen so many little, you know, young pines that are literally half an inch, 1 inch, and just thousands and thousands and thousands of them. So it's been a good year for reproduction.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You'll probably see a great crop of wild critters coming in behind it, too. Usually a burst in winter nutrition. It makes for a better, you know, hatch and turkeys and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm hopeful on the turkey hatch. I haven't been able to, you know, get out there and investigate as we do, you know, specifically to see turkey tracks and what the population has looked like and the poults and all that. But I think you're absolutely right. You know, that rainfall, when you have a good year of rainfall, it usually affects everything, and everything flourishes. So hopefully that's the case.
Mm-hmm. Lanny, look like you got a question.
Well, I mean, if you watching you play the keyboard, it is amazing. And for me, who's personally hard for me to chew gum and walk at the same time, I just have to ask, I mean, are you ambidextrous? How do you pull that off?
You know, there's a lot to do with the left brain, right brain thing and left hand, right hand. One of my mentors and someone that I met when I first came into the Stones was a gentleman named Ian Stewart that we affectionately call Stu. Stu was actually the founding member of the Rolling Stones. He put an ad in the paper that was asking for musicians that love the blues to come and play. And so Mick and Keith showed up, and eventually they became the Rolling Stones. Well, anyway, Stu had a great left hand, and he was an excellent boogie-woogie player. And if you not understand the style of boogie-woogie, the left hand is doing a certain pattern, and then the right hand plays more freely. Well, I asked Stu, I said, Stu, how do you get that left hand and, you know, the independence thing going? He said, Chuck, hold your tie your right hand behind your back, play that left hand figure until your hands hurt, and then play it some more. And then you can release your right hand and play one or two single notes until you can, you know, eventually just keep growing and growing and trying to get that independence. But, you know, it's a craft. It takes a lot of practice. By no means am I the expert, but I do enjoy dabbling.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it really is.
I got to say,
a true gift.
Yeah. Here's my bragging for the day for him, because I remember hearing Mick talk about his musical influences early on, and one of them is a true, true pioneer, is from here. The Howlin' Wolf is from West Point, Mississippi.
Oh, man.
Sure is. And I remember seeing Mick talk about his many musical influences early on, and we mentioned that name, it just gave me chill bumps, because that's one of, we have the Howlin' Wolf. But Howlin' Wolf Blues Festival here every year.
It's actually coming up this weekend.
How about that?
The answer is.
So anyway, I thought that would hit a note with you too. It's pretty cool we got someone like that from here. He doesn't sometimes get enough, I think, you know, attention.
No, we're from the blues here. For
yeah,
sure.
we pulled in Eric Gales a couple years ago. That was awesome.
Yeah.
Eric was here just a few days ago in Macon playing a concert with Buddy Guy, who's, of course, on his farewell tour. Buddy Guy is 87 years old, out there.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing, great? Yeah.
First time I saw Buddy Guy play, I was at my cabin when I was a kid, and we had a black and white, like a 6-inch TV screen, and Austin City Limits came on.
Yep.
And I saw Buddy Guy, you know, playing with his teeth and behind his head and stuff. And
I can't believe you don't have your Austin City
shirt on. So,
all right, Chuck, Mac's raising his hand one more time. What you got, Mac?
So with a conservation forward mindset with timber production and harvest, what do you think is the sweet spot for basal area and what you like to cut?
That's what I had written down to ask you. That's not a one-word answer either. Good question, Mac.
And I think you're referring to pines, right?
Yes.
Well, you're right. It's not a one-word answer because, as we know, we go through different phases. You know, when you plant seedlings that are 6 inches high and you're planting them usually in about 8 to 12 feet apart, and then maybe 6 feet in between the trees and the rows,
right,
as you go along the rows. And then, of course, as time goes on, you're going to start thinning. I don't think that you can really say what is the ideal, because eventually you want to get to that maturity, right? And then what is your goal? Is your goal to have a production forest so that you're really going to concentrate on the economic value of the trees? Or if you're like me, is the goal more a combination of wildlife habitat and forestry going forward? So, you know, in our case, we have different tracks that have different age groups on them, and we manage them according to, of course, what the age group is and what's required. But, you know, I think for someone like myself that's not in it just for economic purposes, You know, I'm going to probably have a much lower basal area than someone that's going to be growing a productive forest. So it's a difficult thing to answer. It really depends on your goals and you know, what you're trying to do with the land.
I've noticed more and more of the larger management groups, whether they're, you know, paper companies or, you know, large landowners, tend to do exactly as Chuck, and they tend to harvest a few more in the at thinning. And for economic reasons, they're getting to saw timber quicker that way too. But, you know, good old saying, another great one-liner for conservation is, nothing good happens till sunlight hits the ground, you know.
That's right.
So that's kind of goes into what he's saying. I've always said, let the stand tell you, because another thing, if you've got really good cutters to get the junk out of there, you know. Too.
Yes.
In some places, you know, you might be down to 60. In some places, you might have as much as 80. It just depends on the stand that you have. Mm-hmm. That's a great question.
That's exactly right. It's so true. And you know, there's an art to everything, as we all know. And there's certainly an art to forestry, you know, to the practice of forestry. And one of the things that concerns me a little bit these days, and believe me, as you guys know, there's some great institutions. The University of Georgia has the Warnell School of Forest Resources, great school. Auburn has fantastic agricultural and forestry programs. Duke University, and on and on. There's some great institutions. But the thing that I wish they would do more of that they did in the old days is to get those foresters out into the field and teach them what boots on the ground and marking trees is all about. You know, if you have a operator select, which is, of course, means the person that's in that big machine cutting down trees, he can't look at that whole tree up and down. He can't see if there's a crook in it, if there's a fork in it. And a trained forester that's going to be walking the ground, looking around, seeing, you know, where the healthy trees are, where the unhealthy ones. And as you mentioned a moment ago, if you take the lesser trees out as you go through this process, and you're going to have a healthier and healthier forest as time goes on.
Amen. We learned that in forestry. Yeah,
see, I learned too. I got upset when they took out too many in one tract, and there were some, but they were some really, Chris Hawley helped me find them. They're really skilled at what they're doing. The operator had the eye part, which is not that common, as you know. But anyway, I got to an area that they'd over-harvested, and I just got so upset about it. And it turns out it's one of the most productive attractions to wildlife, because when we burn it, so much more good stuff then comes back. Because it still, after 8 years, hadn't canopied completely, and there's a lot of stuff to eat. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'd say the same thing. In answer to Mac's question, for me, is diversity. You know, mm-hmm. If you let them go get the junk out, you're going to have a different, every acre is going to be different.
I was reading an article about a forest in the Northeast where they only remove the inferior trees. And in the end, after, I don't know, I think it's been managed that way for like 60, 70 years, it's ended up being higher, more productive than it was before they were harvesting the good trees.
Another thing he pointed out is so critical is like, because when you clear cut pines, you can go right back in like growing soybeans or corn, you know, it's just on a longer rotation. But when you completely clear cut hardwoods, and I know that's a lot of forestry strategy believes in that, then, you know, you won't see it again in if my kid's lifetime really to be harvestable. I loved what he said though. He was harvesting hardwood select, but he wasn't harvesting just for money. Cause that, you know, around here, people every 10 or 15 years ago in select cut their hardwood, but they're high grading it. So they're getting the preferred species out of there because they're just going for dollars. He's going for preferred species. Then the stuff I want out of there, right. You know, this Preston Winters track is just incredible. There's a bottom here, 4 or 5 miles long. And for this guy had a dimension mill, which is axe handles and hoe handles and stuff. And for 50 or 60 years, he wouldn't allow an oak tree to be planted. So when he passed away, he left it to Mississippi State in a trust, a foundation. And so they cut a record board feet off 1 acre of cherry bark oak that they've ever registered anywhere. And it was just like this park for miles of nothing. And it had so much wildlife. Now, subsequently, they've had to go in and harvest differently now. But my point for him was over time, he was taking the stuff out to make room for the wildlife preferred species. And next thing you know, it was incredible. Right. That's what he does.
Yeah.
Boy, that's the thing to do if you care about the wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
Amen. Well, gentlemen, listen, this has been really, really great to spend time with you. Thank you so much for inviting me on to the show. I hope we can do it again sometime. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, I hope so. We really enjoyed it.
And best of luck in your travels and Hackney Diamonds. I'm hoping for a tour.
Yeah.
I love the new single, Angry. Yeah. So.
Well, and Chuck, we do appreciate you being on here. We are fans. We're going to promote you on the social media and encourage everybody to watch your documentaries and your books.
Absolutely.
And we're cheering for you, and we'd like to do this again. And look, we're going to let you be like a tree.
And leave.
And leave.
He's known for the cornballs.
There's more where that came from.
I'm sure. Well, listen, great discussion, guys. Thank you for all you're doing at Mossy Oak. You guys are great promoters of conservation and the environment. So let's stay in touch. And here's to next time.
There you go.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Get this guy some trees.
See you.
Yes.
Wow. What an interesting guy.
100%.
Unbelievable. So I want to encourage everybody to, there's so many topics and he's done so many inspirational things and we touch them, but just Google his name, Google these different, and we can post them too. There's such a multitude of things for people to, and the other thing I would encourage people to do is that, you know, because of his name on some of this, people that wouldn't normally pay attention to it might. So exactly. If you're out there and you're a follower of Gamekeepers and you love what we're doing, pass along the information about Chuck to some people you want to influence in the right way for, you know, trees, wildlife, and so forth.
He is the perfect vehicle for that.
Yes, he absolutely
is. Especially people on the fence.
He's done so many things. Some of the stuff I learned in the Tree Man movie and reading on him, he didn't even mention today. There's more than we even mentioned.
No.
It's just incredible what a life and what a trail he's blazed for all of this.
Yeah, I wanted to get a marriage tip from him. Anybody been married 50 years?
Hey, and 50 years and in the profession he's in.
Yeah.
I mean, you can definitely tell the yin and yang is him, his pieces at his farm, you know.
Yep.
And
41 over here now.
Oh, look at you.
How about that?
We'll listen to him too.
They say the first 45 are the toughest.
Yeah. I hope so.
All right. Well, gosh, Dudley, I know you had these rapid fires.
I did.
I know you had them. So let's save them. We'll get him again.
We're going to get him again.
Okay. Mac had a trivia question. Mac, why don't you ask Toxie the trivia question?
Oh, that's
a good
great one.
Let's see if Toxie
can. Yeah, because my phone friend is Bobby. So if I can't answer it, I'm going to leave it to him.
So we're going to make it pretty easy.
Wait a minute. If this is the one you teed up for Chuck?
This is.
Yeah.
Then I'm gonna fail.
I actually think you've got a knowledge about this.
Okay, so this will be a true or false question, and you're playing for Turner 4400, and the prize is a Gamekeeper Edition wood duck box.
So, just so you know, Turner, whether I get this right or not, you're going to get the box.
Right.
Because I get to make that
call. So it's 50-50. So, true or false. Coulter pines are most easily identifiable by their massive spiny cones, which can be as long as 20 inches and are the heaviest and largest of any true pine cone, weighing up to 8 pounds.
Coulter pines? I would just have to say true, guessing it.
It is true.
8 pound pine cone.
Yeah, I picked some. Are they out west?
Yeah.
In the western, you brought US some home.
Yeah. I brought some that were like, I measured one was 13 inches long.
That's big.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr.
That's a giant pine cone.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remembered you saying you brought some back. So.
We did. I got a garbage sack. I still use them for Christmas decorations.
That's hilarious. My grandmother.
We had a plane out there, so I just like take back what I want. So I got two black garbage bags full of those big long pine cones and brought them back.
They're called, Mac, they're called Coulter pines.
Yeah,
is there a more of a slang name, Dudley? That
no, but that's funny you say that. My mom and grandmother used to like fly to San Francisco, get in a car, go collect pine cones, and fly them back. I have closets of pine cones.
You know, they had great big pine cones, but this one you're talking about had, they were long, they were big and long.
I think that might be a sugar pine. I'm terrible on my western
pines.
They're
huge. They're huge. I mean, there's.
Well, Turner 44, you're going to get a box.
Well, he was going to get one anyway. Yeah. You know, catch the right guy.
I've got a funny story about the pine cone collection. So when I was a kid, I had a pet hamster, and its name was Harriet. And one time it got away and we just forgot about it. I didn't see it. I thought it had died. And about 2 years later, we found it in the closet of pine cones. It had been living off the seeds of the Christmas pine.
It lived for two years in your closet.
Yes. Wow.
No moisture. What was it drinking?
My mom was. It freaked my mom out. I had no idea.
Here's another pine trivia thing. Out when I was in New Mexico, their turkeys in a lot of that area, they have to live off the pine seed and the pine nuts to survive. So when they have a mass failure on pine nuts, they have a terrible time raising turkeys and keeping them. I didn't know that the pine could be such a valuable food source in areas of the country.
It is.
Yeah. I think squirrels store those things too. They build what they call middens, where they squirrels store.
That might be what they call them. I don't know.
But they're pine nuts. They're tall. What's the small pines that grow that put out so many pine nuts?
Pinones out in the southwest.
So our short leaf and slash or whatever down here, that's a different seed, right?
They're much smaller.
Yeah. But
yeah, like those pinones, you know, what's that? You can make pesto out of them and all kinds of cool stuff.
Wow.
All right. Well, why don't we get on out of here, let Dudley and Lanny go burn whatever they're going to do.
Let's go set some fires.
Yeah.
Fire.
be thy careful.
Looking at Dudley. It's about that time. Why don't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley.
Get us out of here, Richie.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife Magazine. And don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt Podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.